Welcome to Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.
And what we did immediately after we got the mill was we started ordering other grains.
Like spelt and kamut. Now baker Eric Shedler mills 5 different grains in-house. We watch the process, and then we bake a pie with a kamut pie dough. Northeastern Nebraska is a hot spot for contaminated groundwater, but a new plan aims to help farmers address the problem. And we talked to author and musician Frida Love Smith about times in her life when food and drumming intersected. Here's Mark Chilla with the news.
A couple of soda stories from the week, Annie. The UK and Canada released reports last month detailing efforts to reduce sugar in their respective countries, with 2 very different approaches. Public Health England's latest report calls for food and beverage industries to reduce the amount of sugar in their products by 20% by 2020. So far, the agreement is voluntary, leaving many to worry that there is no way to enforce food manufacturer and restaurant compliance. Meanwhile, Canada wants to take a more tried-and-true approach, a levy on sugary drinks. It's the same strategy other countries have implemented, including Mexico, France, and Hungary. The levy would also raise $43 billion in government revenue, which would support subsidies for produce, physical activity initiatives, and other health education activities. Then on to Philadelphia, where the city council voted to impose a tax on sugar-sweetened drinks last summer. But this week, a panel of judges in a Pennsylvania appeals court is expected to hear oral arguments in a lawsuit brought by the beverage industry against the city. The plaintiffs include the American Beverage Association and the Pennsylvania Food Merchants Association. They're seeking to invalidate the tax. As NPR's Allison Aubrey reported, the legal challenge has to put the brakes on the city's planned expansion of programs that are funded by the revenues from the tax. Currently, the revenue is funding 2,000 pre-K spots for low-income families in the city. But now the city says it will not add an additional 1,000 seats as previously planned. And a new report from researchers at the Johns Hopkins Center for a Livable Future says a lack of legal rights for migrant workers leads to increased risks for food safety. The report calls for immigration reform that would give legal status to undocumented workers so they can organize, get access to health care, and fight for better working conditions. The report estimates that up to 70% of farm workers in the U.S. lack citizenship and work authorization. Farm workers have a high risk of injuries, exposure to harmful chemicals, and other hazards that they are reluctant to report for fear of deportation. The American Farm Bureau Federation has called for immigration reforms to prevent worker shortages that can crush the agriculture sector and increase food prices. The Johns Hopkins report also calls for provisions for whistleblowers, raising minimum wage, providing a path to citizenship, and allowing visa holders to switch employers. You can read more at eartheats.org and on our Twitter feed.
Good stuff. Thanks, Mark.
Anytime.
Decades of intensive farming have contaminated the groundwater across many parts of the plains, but a new kind of plan may help farmers in northeastern Nebraska address the problem. Ariana Brocious reports for Harvest Public Media.
Farmers rely on nitrogen fertilizer to maximize their bushels of corn and soybeans, but nitrogen not used by plants, because too much was applied, or the timing was off, or the rain or irrigation washed it away, makes it into the water supply. At a nitrogen management class in the small town of Creighton, Nebraska, Tanner Jenkins shows a group of about 40 farmers a chart of groundwater data. He works for a local groundwater district.
The nitrates over time, you can see that red line is the nitrate trend. We're on a pretty steady upward click.
Farms sit shoulder to shoulder across this part of the High Plains, where shallow water tables and sandy soil have accelerated the movement of nitrates into the groundwater. Excessive nitrates in drinking water is especially dangerous for newborns and pregnant women. It can hurt the body's ability to move oxygen in the blood. But Jenkins says this isn't new information for the producers in the room.
This issue that we're having is long-standing. The community we're currently in Creighton, Nebraska, as a part of this groundwater impairment, has actually had to install an industrial-size reverse osmosis system to provide potable water for the town.
More than 7,000 people in this region rely solely on groundwater contaminated by nitrates. Jenkins coordinates a program trying to clean the water up. But Marty Link of the Nebraska Department of Environmental Quality says it's hard to address pollution that doesn't come from one specific source.
Non-point source is from widespread application of a pollutant, such as widespread application of fertilizer or manure used as fertilizer. It's coming from all over the place. You can't really put it to an actual address or point.
Pollution coming from a specific place, like out of a factory, can be regulated. But here, the area of concern spreads across four local groundwater districts that each have their own water quality rules. In 2011, the districts decided to work together, along with the state, to address the problem comprehensively. Last fall, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency approved their plan, making it the first in the country to qualify for funding normally reserved for surface water projects. Link says this new funding could make a big difference for Nebraska, where 85% of the population relies on groundwater.
Getting a groundwater management plan accepted by EPA is like chocolate sundae with sprinkles on top. It's wonderful. It really is a great opportunity.
Though it's possible the funds could be impacted by President Trump's proposed cuts to the EPA, Link hopes their collaborative work could serve as a model for other farm communities dealing with high groundwater nitrates. The new plan will provide more money to treat the problem at its source, helping farmers adopt practices that reduce the amount of nitrates getting into the groundwater. Those are things like planting cover crops, deep soil sampling, and more efficient irrigation methods.
Some people really embrace these programs and try to utilize the different tools.
Steve Keck is an independent agronomist who's worked with area farmers for decades. The success of this groundwater cleanup relies on more producers taking advantage of the cost share programs. But Keck says because they're voluntary, participation is mixed.
There's some people that they don't want to have the government involved in their business whatsoever, so it's individual.
Jim Fuchman is one of the producers who's taken advantage of existing funding. On his 100-year-old farm near Creighton, he uses cover crops and tests the amount of nitrogen and moisture in his soil before he applies fertilizer.
Cost share makes it appealing. Somebody's sharing in the cost with us. They're helping us to look at it. They're helping us to find new ways to be better.
He says the region's long-standing nitrate problem is the result of practices from farmers in decades past, rather than today's producers. His family relies on a home reverse osmosis system for their drinking water because some of his wells have nitrate levels 2 to 3 times the safe drinking standard. But he says he's not that concerned, and margins are tight, so he and other producers don't want to waste expensive fertilizer.
It's contaminated water, as some would view it, but that nitrogen is good for crops, and I'm able to pull that out of there and utilize some of it, so it saves me on some of my fertilizer costs.
If they can convince enough farmers to make changes, the groundwater districts hope to stop nitrate levels from increasing within 5 years. They expect it will take up to 20 years to bring them back down to the safe drinking range. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Ariana Brocious.
That story was produced by NET News in Nebraska. More at harvestpublicmedia.org. Bloomington native Frida Love Smith is a legend in the local punk scene. She was the drummer in the Blake Babies, Antenna, and the Mysteries of Life in the 80s and 90s. The Paste columnist chronicles her life in music and her love of food in her memoir, Red Velvet Underground. Along with rock and roll memories, we follow her cooking lessons with her son, Jonah. One of their first lessons was how to bake bread, which is fitting because one of the first times music and food collided for her was as a teenager working in a Bloomington bakery. She was making a French bread that required pounding the dough. But I had to start with her legacy at a different local bakery called Soma. Okay, so first of all, I did not realize that you were the creator of the Cosmic Muffin. So a celebrity is in my midst.
Ah, thank you.
Can you talk about how you came up with this idea for this recipe?
It was a long time ago, but I do remember it well because it was such a fun process, and it was the first time that I created, really kind of the last time that I created a commercial product. But I was really in collaboration with the owners of the bakery as they're opening Soma Bakery and Coffee Shop, and they wanted to offer vegan treats. And I think the idea for the Cosmic Muffin was that it would be this mega brand muffin, that it would be a complete meal in itself, and that we would just put as much stuff as possible in it, and ideally it would still be tasty and easy enough to make every day.
Are you going to go get one?
I think I will go get one. I usually do.
I love the story of you baking bread at the Daily Bread with a baseball bat. And it just seemed to me like this is exactly what a drummer-to-be should be doing.
Oh, absolutely. It was very physical. It was very rhythmic. And not only that, there was a soundtrack. I was, you know, having this experience and baking this bread while I was listening to a band that would become really formative and really important to me. I can't separate the Velvet Underground from that experience. It's all so tied together. I can't say that I became a drummer because I made that bread, but they're very linked in my mind. And people do think that, you know, my love of food, my experience with food, and my experience as a drummer seem like these disparate things, but they don't seem like that to me. And I think part of it is that physicality.
Okay, let's go to this. You talk to musicians for Paste magazine.
I do.
I've really enjoyed reading some of your Q&As, and so I want to bring up the one with Joey Santiago of the Pixies.
Right.
Your questions are exactly the questions that I want to ask you, so I'm going to turn some around.
Oops. Oh, great. No one's ever asked me those questions.
So I've got two here. When you were on tour, what food from home did you crave?
I had a really long conversation once in the van when I was on a Some Girls tour about the things that we were missing at home. It just kind of went on for hours and hours. And it's really simple, basic things, but things that are hard to get on the road. So we had this long conversation about millet, about how when we got home, we would make a pot of millet. And then, I guess a little bit more interesting or a little bit more sophisticated than that, just talking about the way that I make a coconut curry. And I can't really describe exactly what it is, but just the way that I make it taste exactly the way I want, with, you know, not very sweet, maybe a little more lime juice, maybe a little bit spicier. And there's something about being able to make something taste exactly the way you want it that you really long for when you're on tour, and you just have to take what you get, and you don't have that sense of control and that direct connection with the food that you're eating. And it makes you get really obsessed with food.
So another question you have in this conversation with Joey Santiago, what's your pre-show food ritual?
So I do like to eat. A lot of singers don't like to eat anything before they play, but I don't sing. Drumming is really physical, so I need to eat something. I have a really hard time if I don't. But if I eat something very heavy or very large, then I do notice that my playing is sluggish. I'll tend to play a little slower. But something lighter like a miso soup and some sushi is really, really good.
Sushi and miso soup sounds like the poshest tour food.
I know, it's true.
Were you really eating like that on tour?
Well, you're lucky if you can get that. More likely, if they feed you at the venue, you'll get some kind of crappy spaghetti. One of the musicians that I interviewed talked about gigatoni. Which was a word that he coined for the plate of pasta with super sweet store-bought tomato sauce that they throw at you when they have to feed the band. So if I'm faced with a plate of gigatoni, I'll just have a few bites of it, and maybe there'll be some carrots and hummus in the dressing room, and I can kind of pull something together.
There's a really brief story that you tell about hearing Meat is Murder by the Smiths for the very first time. That jump-started your vegetarianism.
It did.
You then say that you're embarrassed to admit it, the very next paragraph. Why are you embarrassed to admit that?
I guess I never shared with anybody, even in the moment, that hearing that song inspired me so instantaneously and so completely.
You got the cow mooing in the background, this weird industrial machine sound.
it's a powerful piece of propaganda, mm-hmm. and that's what it's really meant to be. And maybe I didn't want to admit that I was the kind of person that a powerful piece of propaganda could work so effectively on, but it did. This beautiful creature must die. A death for no
reason, and death for no reason is murder. There's this part in the book where you say the drums overwhelmed you. They got the better of you. What do you mean by that?
Part of it was a size thing, like being a small woman, and my first drum kit wasn't sized to me. I think because a lot of the bands that I was really into were kind of powerful punk bands, I was trying to emulate something that was a little bit beyond me physically. It took me some time to come to terms with my own physical limitations and my own technical limitations.
Have you ever felt that way in the kitchen, in your cooking life?
I have. There are parallels because, you know, again, I haven't taken cooking classes. I didn't go to culinary school. It's not something that I've done publicly, so I haven't had maybe as strong of those pangs. But I have had moments. I mean, I write about food a lot now. I love food. I'm really passionate about it. And I do have some professional experience. But again, I sort of jumped in with all my enthusiasm and all, you know, my interest and my passion for it.
Let's think about maybe one of the most simple recipes, a good beginner recipe that you can make in your sleep. And then think about one of the first drum parts that you learned. Simple, you mastered it. Again, you can play it in your sleep. I'm putting you on the spot, I know.
No, that's okay. I mean, I think with Jonah, the lessons that we had around making stir fry were really productive. Like, I feel like a lot of what we were working on with the cooking lessons started to coalesce for him. That was a really good basic, not even recipe, but more sort of technique for him to learn. He learned how to improvise, to sort of make a meal out of whatever you happen to have. And then as far as a drum beat, I can actually kind of hear the drum beat in my head, but it's a little bit hard to explain, but just kind of...
Can you speak the drum beat?
Oh, I've never tried to do this before, but just a simple sort of eighth note funk drum beat, like...
And the... Is the bass drum?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So what do those two things, stir fry and a simple eighth note funk beat?
Yeah, let's say that.
What do those two things have in common?
I would say their versatility. It's kind of like having a trick in your bag, like something that you can pull out that will almost always work. And once you know it, you've got it under your belt.
Frida Love Smith writes about the intersection of food and music in her memoir, Red Velvet Underground. The interview first aired in 2015, and an extended cut is at eartheats.org. The website is also the place to go to support what we do here at Earth Eats. We're accepting your gifts of a couple bucks a month, maybe $10 a month. It helps us continue to do the weekly show, yes, and it also supports the website and the Twitter feed, these free services that we hope enhance your food life. Go to eartheats.org, click the Give Now button in the upper right, select WFIU Public Radio, and then take it from there. Oh, and hey, if you give $10 a month, you can get our new cookbook as a thank you gift. Go big with $15 a month and get the book plus the Earth Eats tote bag. Yes. Okay, thanks so much for giving. It really, truly means so much. Hang tight today for our story coming up about a local baker who mills his own Kamut flour. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses. Located on the Beeline Trail, more information at personalfinancialservices.net. Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. And Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets, from gluten-free to kosher and halal.
Food for everyone, everywhere. Full menu and truck location available at urgentfoods.com. We've spoken with Eric Shedler on Earth Eats before. He's the baker and co-owner of Muddy Fork Bakery. I visited him at the bakery a couple months ago when I heard that he was milling his own flour.
Where is it?
Oh, okay, the mill is here.
It's smaller than you might.
The stones are in here, so it's got 8 or 10 inch stones in it.
Oh.
So it's two stones. In this mill, the bottom stone is the running stone. So one stationary and one moves.
It's not a big machine. It sort of blends in with everything else in the bakery. It's Thursday when I visit. That's his milling day, so that he can mix the starters and then bake on Fridays. He calculates exactly how much flour he'll need so that he doesn't have any extra.
But I think the next one that we're going to do is probably this belt. We need about 100 grams less than a 50-pound sack, so we're just going to mill the whole sack.
Eric realized he would have to start milling in-house when his source of flour dried up.
We had been using fresh milled flour from a farmer in Seymour, and that was sort of what we got started with. And when she lost her grain in the middle of the season, she had a problem with her silo. Then we started ordering commercial sacks of wheat and rye, and it just doesn't have the flavor that a fresh product has. And it also has a bitterness to it.
He bought the mill about a year and a half ago.
And what we did immediately after we got the mill was we started ordering other grains.
Ancient grains like spelt and kamut. They also mill hard red wheat, white wheat, and rye.
We're making a lot more whole grain breads now than we were because we love the flour and it makes such great bread. And we are making new varieties that we've developed in the past year that really take advantage of the different grains.
Take the kamut, for instance. It has a yellow tint to it. It's about 3 to 4 times bigger than a regular hard wheat berry, and it's very hard. Turns out he has to mill it twice to get the flour fine enough.
It's very interesting to work with. It took a long time to figure out how to get a nice dough out of it. It needs lots of water. We recently found out that the best way to handle the dough is by putting water on your hands and on the table instead of flour. Okay, so we're going to mill the spelt. I got my earplugs in.
For the spelt, he sets the hopper opening on the mill to 3. That dictates how much grain pours into the stone chamber.
I'm going to turn on the mill and put in just a little bit with a scoop and then tighten the stones till I get the grind that I want, and then I'll toss in a whole bucket.
It's this loud for 4 hours. While he does other tasks around the bakery, he uses his ears and his nose to make sure everything is going according to plan. If the stones start rubbing together, that's bad, and he'll hear a loud screeching. He'll also smell burning if the grain gets warmer than 100 degrees, and he adjusts accordingly. Eric mixed up some pie doughs with the kamut flour, and he brought the dough over to his friend Malcolm Doglish's house. Malcolm is a musician and composer, and he also makes a wicked apple pie. There aren't many components to his recipe, the idea being he wants the Gold Rush apples to be the main attraction. Today, even though he's the home baker, Malcolm is teaching Eric, the professional baker, how to make this pie. They're prepping for an event of music and dance that Malcolm's coordinating.
Oh, okay. What would you
The show ends with complimentary slices of pie for all 400 audience members, so it's all hands on deck.
A little texture with some regular flour.
Malcolm calls it a pizza pan apple pie because that's what he cooks it on. It's a large pizza pan, probably 2 feet in diameter, and in the middle he's placed a cleaned-out tuna fish can. That'll make sense in a minute. One pizza pan apple pie can be divided into 10 to 12 pieces, he says.
The apple slinky.
Remember how many apples.
Another sous chef today is Kelsey Smith. She's peeling apples with one of Eric's daughters. Then they slice 5 of the peeled apples into discs. Okay, all the prep is done. Eric takes the kamut pie dough out of the fridge while Malcolm lays down some almond flour and white flour on the table.
It's actually follows the classic pie dough ratios, for those who want to know. It's by weight, 3 parts flour to 2 parts butter to 1 part water.
What is it again?
It's 3 parts flour to 2 parts butter to 1 part water by weight.
Oh, okay. It's been in a refrigerator, and I'm kind of doing just a little boola-boola with the hands to soften it up a bit. And so I just sort of go around like the hands of a clock with the pin. And because this is a one-crust unit, the outside is going to be pleated. You'll see what I'm talking about.
He places the rolled out dough on top of the tuna can on the pizza pan, sort of like an inverted donut.
Now we got this apple. Where is it? Here we go. Yes. Okay. So
Malcolm arranges the apple rings around that middle bump, and then he takes the edges of the crust that are hanging off the pan and he crimps them together to cover up the apples.
That is good. So now
the topping. Cold butter, almond slivers, a pinch of salt, and some cinnamon sugar.
You got your butter, you got your salt, you got your almonds. And the almonds go under the pleats like this, kind of like this. And I just kind of finesse it into there like that. And now this is ready. So Judy, could you open that oven really quick? With this pie, they cook rather fast. So what I do is I kind of go by smell, because what happens is the apples reach a point where they get to a certain temperature and they just go like that, and they just let out this incredible apple aroma. So I go by smell, and I also go by ear. I open up the oven, and if I hear, you know, a little boily boily, then I get it out of there, because you do not want an applesauce pie.
Musician and home baker Malcolm Doglish. His pizza pan apple pie is just the best. It's at eartheats.org. And Eric Shedler of Muddy Fork Bakery milled the Kamut flour for this recipe.
So that's looking pretty cool. Yeah, you can sort of, if you want to put...
That means it's time to get it out. Right?
So that means, yeah, that the apples have spoken.
This was a special one for us. We dedicate this pie to the memory of our good friend, Toby Strout. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Urgent Foods, a locally owned food truck offering gourmet choices for all lifestyles, tastes, and diets. From vegetarian to paleo and low carb. Taste matters. Your taste. Current truck location is available at whereisurgent.com. And Elizabeth Rue, enrolled agent and owner of Personal Financial Services, providing tax preparation for individuals and businesses, located on the Beeline Trail. More information at personalfinancialservices.net. I want to give a shout out to everyone who's already supported Earth Eats with a financial gift. Now it's your turn. Go to eartheats.org. Click Give Now, then WFIU Public Radio. From there, you can choose to get our new cookbook for a gift of $10 a month, or the book plus an Earth Eats tote bag for $15 a month. Bottom line, your gift helps us keep Earth Eats free, the podcast, the website, all of it. So, thanks. I'm Annie Corrigan. Bye-bye.